Hello, you're listening to the Brainy Speech Therapist podcast. We're your hosts, Helen McLean and Jan McIntosh Brown. Here, we aim to look at all aspects of brain injury, from the research to the rehabilitation, and always through the lens of speech and language therapy. Hello everyone, welcome to another episode of the Brainy Speech Therapist podcast. We're your hosts, Helen McLean.
And I'm Jan McIntosh Brown.
So tonight we are delighted to be joined by Dr. Hashir Aj, PhD, who is the Director of Hashir International Specialist Clinics and Research Institute for Misophonia, Tinnitus and Hyperacusis. He has a degree in audiology, Master's in Rehabilitative Audiology and a PhD in Public Health and Policy from London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine at the University of London. He has trained and supervised over 1,000 audiologists and psychologists in his International Tinnitus Masterclass and published over 50 research papers in the field of audiology. So Dr. Aj, we're delighted that you've found some time to join us tonight, and thank you for not only for joining us, but for putting up with some technical issues while we were getting ourselves connected. But I would ask you just to maybe kind of tell us a little bit more about yourself before we kind of dive into the topic of particularly hyperacusis tonight.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you, Helen and Jan, for having me and organizing this podcast. And as I was telling you earlier, it is very much encouraging to see that speech and language therapy colleagues become interested in supporting patients with hyperacusis, which I think really is a room for improvement in terms of the services that are already is being provided to these patients. And I think that a speech and language therapist can also play a very significant role, being already a therapist. So you can bring a lot of things to the table for these patients. What is it exactly you can do to support these patients is a different story. But when but once the relationships are built up, and you can see these patients, see what other therapists are doing for them, and then you can say, okay, this is something that I can do, the particular intervention that we do, for example, for something else, and for patients with hyperacusis as well. So this is what basically happened with our colleagues in occupational therapy and health psychology and clinical psychology. So we gradually involved them into the therapy sessions for patients with hyperacusis, and they could see what are the areas that these patients have difficulties. And they had all certain interventions or techniques or approaches that could actually bring into the general therapy program to help the patient address specific parts of their problem, which we couldn't as audiologists, we're not really focusing on during the treatment. My background is audiology, and I became interested in hyperacusis through my specialism of tinnitus rehabilitation. And tinnitus is a ringing in the ears, which people can have in one ear, both ears, or inside the head. And they constantly, they're hearing this buzzing noise or a whistling sound or a combination of the noises 24/7, which impacts on their life. So we were working with a lot of patients, helping them to cope with tinnitus. And then about 50% of people who have tinnitus also become sensitive to sound. And this level of sensitivity to sound is to a point that basically it interrupts their day-to-day activities, or it impacts on their mood. For example, they can't go to certain places, or they feel very anxious when they are around noises, or they start self-isolating and feeling a bit having a lower mood. And this is how we became I became interested in hyperacusis. And because it was very prevalent among patients that we were trying to help. So hyperacusis, by definition, is hyperacusis by definition is when people become intolerance of certain loud sounds. And we were talking about loud sounds like the traffic noises and kitchen sounds and noise in the workplace. And and they feel these sounds are too loud for them. And it sometimes can even hurt their ears. And then they will get the diagnosis for hyperacusis if this sensitivity to sound impacts on their life. So if they are just sensitive to sound, but it doesn't really influence their life, they doesn't really get the diagnosis of hyperacusis. They have the diagnosis of hyperacusis when they it shows that their sound intolerance is interrupting their day-to-day activities or it influencing on their mood. That's when they get the diagnosis of hyperacusis. And the hyperacusis is not only prevalent among people with tinnitus, it's also prevalent in general population and with other people with other illnesses and syndromes, like head trauma is one of those things, depression is another one, and some of the auditory conditions can also have hyperacusis as a side effect. Some medications can cause hyperacusis, and temporary hyperacusis can be even generated if people have impacted wax in their ears, and then when they remove the ear wax from their ears, for moments they'll have hyperacusis because everything will sound louder. But that's often their brain recalibrates itself, and they no longer hear the sounds louder than normal. In some people, it can carry on to be that loud for a long period of time, which then turn into that diagnosis of hyperacusis because it will impact on their life, make them anxious, so on and so forth.
So here we work with people that have had acquired brain injuries. So I'm just wondering, you mentioned that was one of the probable cause of hyperacusis. Is there any stats or percentages or how prevalent it might be for people following brain injury?
I have seen just a few case reports for people who had symptoms of hyperacusis following brain injury, and also the other disorders that are listed. There is no real proper epidemiological, if you like, a study in seeing whether there is a higher proportion of people who had brain injury compared to other illnesses may present with symptoms of hyperacusis. So the reason that I know that people with brain injury could have this is because of the case reports that has been published on this, but there is no systematic study that I can think of from the top of my mind that actually says the exact percentages of people who may have hyperacusis following the brain injury or if they had brain injuries. This is probably a good topic for an MSc student to do a research study.
Yeah, it's an interesting one from my clinical experience. So obviously, just anecdotally, when we have people refer to our service, we will ask them quite early on, how's your hearing? Are you getting any ringing in your ears? Have you noticed any changes at all? So that we can refer them on to audiology if it's appropriate. And sometimes people will say to us, you know, it's funny that you're asking that because yes, I have noticed something that's different. And family members will say, you know, but you've not mentioned anything. And I think it's making me wonder if it's an underreported issue in the brain injury population. And is it perhaps because other aspects of their recovery are taking precedence in terms of what's being looked at? But when I do meet people who are having some sort of change to their hearing, it's having quite a huge impact on the lives, on living their lives as they want to.
Exactly. And so it's, I can see that how if they had brain injury and they got in this rehabilitation process, if the hyperacusis is quite severe, it should somehow interrupt your interventions as well. Like if you're trying to say something, because they can become even sensitive to their own voice. and then that the resonance and the it resonates in their own ear. They can become sensitive to your voice, and when you try to teach them things, and so, and plus lots of other noises that they may not want to. In many situations, they may have a choice to, for example, to put a headphone on their ears or cover their ears so not to hear the noises. But if they come to a speech therapy program, that is not really going to be feasible. So they will be more exposed, if you like, to noises that can become bothersome for them. And in severe cases of hyperacusis, which could be in fact in following brain injury, and they can become very sensitive to even the sounds as low, as quiet as 30 decibels. So 30 decibels is almost like the sound of the whisper. So they can feel that sound is too loud for them and it hurts their ears. I had patients who in their house, they all of the windows, they put brick walls behind the windows, soundproofed all of the places in their house. Even in their own house, they had one corner of a room that it was the quiet place, that they're trying to spend most of their time in that quiet place. And it can be a very big issue for many people.
What I've seen, so I work in inpatient rehab, and I've seen from quite severe to people being very physical and verbally aggressive when, you know, they feel overwhelmed by noise, and also, and then the other end of things of people isolating, as you mentioned, and also impacting on their attention. So they'd be trying to do a task, but they'd hear something out of the window, and, you know, they'd be paying attention to all the environmental noises, which we tend to zoom out of, you know, we don't focus on it. But people with hyperacusis forms of brain injury were finding that very difficult.
Exactly. So that's that can become a significant problem for those patients. And so overall, in terms of their sound sensitivity, these are like, there are three different types of sound sensitivity that people can have. One of them is hyperacusis, and then the other one is misophonia, and then the third one is general noise sensitivity. And so these are all they have different characteristics. Let me just share with you the definitions, like how would you diagnose misophonia differentiated from hyperacusis. So for people with hyperacusis, the person with hyperacusis perceives some sounds as too loud, uncomfortable, or painful. So this needs really to be present. So they feel that some sounds are too loud, uncomfortable, or painful. But their main reaction, main complaint, is not decreased tolerance to oral and nasal sounds like eating, chewing gum, lip smacking, mouth noises, breathing, or repetitive sounds like tapping or rustling sounds that made by humans or machines, like finger tapping or typing on a computer keyboard. So their main complaint is not related to this. Because if their main component is related to this, then it is misophonia as opposed to hyperacusis. And also, the person's sound intolerance should not be better explained by the general attitude toward noise and environmental noise pollution, like noise from the neighbors, nearby airports, traffic, workshops, internal plumbing of the house, or air conditioning. So these are mainly characteristics of people with high noise sensitivity or noise sensitive people, which is a more of a personality trait as opposed to be something like hyperacusis. So for people with hyperacusis, they generally need to find certain sounds are too loud. So this noise is too loud, it's hurting my ear, or it's causing discomfort in my head, in my ear, or making me uncomfortable. And the noises that we are talking about are like traffic noises, banging sounds, children screaming, hand dryers in the toilets, this type of noises. But a person with just who is noise sensitive as a personality trait, they may complain of an airport nearby, but the noises may not be really that loud. They're not saying that the noise is too loud and hurting my ear. The very fact that there is a faint noise coming from distance, that is still bother them. Or the neighbors may not really making the noise that they'll reach to their house may not be that loud, but the very fact that the noise coming from some other place to their house, that bothers them. So, or the cracking or the pipe work in the house, they may not be very loud, but they still can be bothersome. So this is that noise sensitivity issue. And misophonia is mainly related to noises that people make. There are other noises as well, but eating noises, breathing noises, chewing gum, biting an apple, this sort of noises are people with misophonia are very sensitive to. And misophonia is less known than hyperacusis. And so we don't know really what is the prevalence of misophonia in people who with brain injury or other disorders.
That's really helpful that you've explained that, because that was something that I know I was really curious to, because I feel like I hear the words misophonia, tinnitus, hyperacusis, but wasn't confident to be able to say what the differences are. But you've explained it really nicely there. Thank you.
You're welcome.
And so if someone is there a process around getting this hyperacusis formally diagnosed from an audiological point of view?
How do we diagnose hyperacusis? Mm-hmm. So there is no golden standard test for it, but majority of people with hyperacusis, they have normal or near to normal hearing. And there is another test that we do, which is a test called uncomfortable loudness levels, that we put the headphones on the ears and send some sounds starting from the thresholds of hearing, gradually make them louder. They are instructed to press the button as soon as the noise is uncomfortable. And they don't have to tolerate the noise at all. As soon as they don't like it, they need to press the button. So we get this threshold of discomfort across the frequency range. And if they're the average across frequencies is less than 77 decibels, that's an indication of hyperacusis. But most of the time, hyperacusis is can also be picked on by using questionnaires. There are questionnaires that you can use in order to explore symptoms of hyperacusis, and also to differentiate it from symptoms of noise sensitivity and misophonia. And there's a questionnaire that we developed, it's called Sound Sensitivity Symptoms Questionnaire, SSSQ, and it's been validated, and which has only 5 questions that you can use in the clinic for a screening. Does this person have any form of sound sensitivity? If yes, what is that? And then there are other questionnaires like hyperacusis impact questionnaire, which basically that's also a short questionnaire with only, I think, 8 questions. And that basically assess whether hyperacusis is impacting on the life of this person. Because if it doesn't impact, it doesn't really classify as hyperacusis. And so you can use this sort of questionnaires as a screening tools. But in my view, the gold standard is to that clinical interview that you do with the patients in order to find out what kind of noises they are sensitive to, what is their reaction, what is their emotional reaction, what is their behavioral reaction, what is the physiological response that they're having towards sound. Does it hurt their ears, does it hurt their head? What kind of avoidance behaviors they may be engaged with, and is it impacting on their mood, so on and so forth, and try to distinguish this from the other problems that they may be having. So usually when we want to make a diagnosis for hyperacusis, it will be based on that clinical interview, but we'll use the audiological tests as well as questionnaires to, you know, as additional data, if you like, to do that. But there are not everyone who is their score are high on the questionnaire will end up to have the diagnosis of hyperacusis, because the way that they answer the question is not always the right way, I guess.
So, and I wanted to ask, Hashir, are all audiologists able to assess for hyperacusis?
No, this is it's a specialized area in audiology, and usually audiologists who are specialized in tinnitus, they will be able to assess for hyperacusis.
Okay, that's great. Because I know that I've had a question about people that I've worked with, and I've tried to find audiologists who are able to assess hyperacusis. It's not easy.
Yes, it's a specialized area within another specialty. So is so they need to know about tinnitus. So they need to be a tinnitus specialist, and then from them there are people who also know about hyperacusis and can make the diagnosis and do any interventions that is needed. In terms of the intervention, it's going to be very minimal. There's not a huge amount of centers who are actually engaged in providing intervention for hyperacusis. For tinnitus is a bit more. That also is not widely available. And but for hyperacusis is less. It's a less known condition, if you like, than tinnitus. And misophonia, again, same thing, is much less known than tinnitus. And so that's why they are, often the GPs even do not refer patients for these conditions to audiology clinics. I cannot remember that having a huge number of hyperacusis only referrals from general practitioners. They were mainly patients with tinnitus who also had hyperacusis. So what do they do with people who go and complain about noise? I don't know, maybe they send them to the council, ask them to come and measure the noise or use some earplugs or so the referrals for hyperacusis itself, but are quite low as well.
I'm wondering, those questionnaires that you mentioned, are they ones that are should only be used by audiologists, or could they be used by someone like a speech and language therapist or a psychologist to potentially kind of help with additional information if they were referring to audiology to say, look, we have done this sound sensitivity questionnaire, we've got this information that suggests this is an issue for this person. Is that something that we could do?
Yeah, absolutely. So the questionnaires are basically it's questions that you give to the patients to complete, and then the result of it you can use in your report. And the questionnaires also I have a tinnitus masterclass, which all of these questionnaires are on the website, and you can basically use the link and it sends you an email with the result of the questionnaire, which you can use for your report if you wanted. If you didn't want to use them online, you can have a paper copy of those questionnaires, which are because they are published questionnaires, so you can, you know, access. I can send you the copy for your reference. Yes.
Yeah, that's great, because I think it's helpful to have things in our toolkit that we can. I think it shows patients that we take these reports seriously, you know, and we've got at least a first kind of measure to kind of go, okay, here's a conversation that we can have start having with you.
Yes, Tinnitus Masterclass is open to professionals that are in the relevant to hearing healthcare. Speech and language therapists is also a part of that group. So, and also occupational therapists, social workers, teachers of the deaf, hearing therapists. So it's a quite a wide range. ENT doctors, psychiatrists. So anybody who wants to extend their scope of practice in helping patients with tinnitus and hyperacusis, they can take part in the course. And the course usually is one part of it is understanding about these conditions. Another part of it is assessment, and then the therapy. The therapy for these heavily focuses on a specialized rehabilitation program based on cognitive behavioral therapy. And because there is no definitive cure for tinnitus or hyperacusis or misophonia. And so the therapy is basically is about understanding why the person is having this reaction to sound. And often there is a cognitive behavioral processes that is leading to the reaction or amplifying the reaction to those particular sounds. And cognitive behavior therapy can basically help them to recognize these cognitive behavioral processes and test them to see whether these are helpful or unhelpful. And if they think that these thought process or avoidance behaviors or ritualistic behaviors that they may be having are unhelpful, then the therapy can help them to gradually modify them. And by doing so, they're breaking this cycle of distress, which can be linked with the noises that they hear. And so if they're hearing the noises and they are very distressed by those noises, their brain want to focus on those noises even more. So they in cognitive behavior therapy, you want to, when they hear the noises, they manage that cycle of distress. So they are no longer distressed by the noises. Therefore, it makes it easier for their brain to recalibrate itself and not to put too much emphasis on those noises. I just wanted to share my screen with you with, if I can, with this questionnaire so you can see for yourself how simple it is. So this is the questionnaire, and so basically if you were going to use this, so you can just put a code here, like whatever name, and doesn't have to be anything on the 85 bell on these two, but you need to put your own email address here so that when you do this, the report will go to you. And it asks, like, within the last 2 weeks, how often you had any of the following problems, like having a problem tolerating sounds because they often seem too loud to you, pain in your ears when hearing certain loud sounds, discomfort, feeling angry or anxious when hearing certain sound related to eating noise, lip smacking, so on and so forth. This is the item 4 is for misophonia. The first 3 items are for hyperacusis. And the fear that certain sounds may make your hearing or tinnitus worse. This is also another type of hyperacusis called fear hyperacusis. And then the last one, getting disturbed because of general environmental noise, noise in your neighborhood, nearby airports, so on and so forth. So item 6 is for a noise sensitivity, if you like. And and then you submit this and the result goes to yourself, mm-hmm. which you can then check and advise your patient.
That's very generous of you to share that. Mm-hmm. Hashir, I was just wondering, I worked with a few people who had in-ear noise generators. Is that still something that's used for sensitive hearing or tinnitus?
It is something that is used, but it's not really very evidence-based intervention. So it again comes from helping people with tinnitus. In the past, we used to give them noise generators. So they put in their ear, basically it sends some other noise to their ears, so they hear their tinnitus less. And but nowadays we consider that as an avoidance behavior. And so they're avoiding their tinnitus by trying to mask it, if you like, or distracting themselves from tinnitus. So it doesn't really address the anxiety that is caused by tinnitus. They're just avoiding the problem. So it may be good in short term, but in the long term, it's going to not to be really very helpful. In CBT, you know, you try the patient to face up with the challenge, hearing tinnitus, and instead of trying to avoid tinnitus, work on the cycle of distress that is caused by tinnitus. So if they hear tinnitus, but they're no longer distressed by it, they give this opportunity to the brain to not to focus onto the tinnitus, to put it into the background. So on the same sort of principle, we used to give sound generators to people with hyperacusis as well. And the idea was that this sound would somehow desensitize their auditory system. But the evidence base for that is very weak. Again, with the CBT, instead of like putting some artificial sound, which may not be even, they may not be even sensitive to, they will have to identify what are the real noises that they are sensitive to, and then gradually expose themselves to those noises. So within the concept of CBT, also they have to face up with the challenge and use noise in order to desensitize themselves, but they will not be dependent on any sort of device, if you like.
And so I'm assuming that patients who swear by just putting in earplugs, and if they know that they're going to into places that they're going to find too noisy, would that be classed as avoidant behaviour?
Yes, that's avoidance behaviour. And it also is, there are some research studies which shows that when you do use the ear protection in places which you're not supposed to, it actually makes your ears even more sensitive. So it is on one hand an avoidance behavior. It will not help with the hyperacusis. It also makes their hearing more sensitive in the long term. So is a very damaging thing to do for people with hyperacusis. But if they have hyperacusis and they have to go to a place and there is no other choices that they can do, then they'll have to use it. They have to use it. And even when they start the therapy, it's not something that we say, okay, you have to not use that right away, because they can't do that. It will be one of the things that they need to gradually taper off, if you like, and not use. I did not have anybody with hyperacusis who will not be able to get rid of their earplugs during the course of the treatment, if you like.
Mm-hmm. Now, this isn't a question that we sort of posed to you in email, Hashir. So if it's not something that is making any sense or anything that you can comment on, please feel free just to go pass. But I was just wondering, is this service funded through the NHS?
There are services that are funded through the NHS, but there are not really that many. And so because it's a specialism that they need to develop. So there are some there are organizations that are trying to promote this. And like NICE guideline had a review a few years ago for tinnitus, not for hyperacusis, but for tinnitus, which is close. Whatever improvements happens for tinnitus, it automatically goes for hyperacusis as well. But that has not been really taken up by most NHS trusts, and so the interventions are not really widely available, and there are some clinics that they do this, but they are very busy, and there are some private clinics that do this as well, but there are not that many, and so maybe just a handful, and so services are quite sparse, if you like.
And so I'm wondering if, in the absence of being able to see a specialist, this maybe is a good opportunity to mention, I know it's about tinnitus, but you've got a book, haven't you, that's about living well with tinnitus.
Yes, exactly, yes. The Living Well with Tinnitus, the techniques in that book can be used for hyperacusis as well. And in that book, we also have some dedicated sections on hyperacusis, because hyperacusis is prevalent among people with tinnitus and they need to know about it. And like, for example, these questionnaires that I talked about, they are in the book as well. So they can use that. They have to see how sensitive they are to sounds. And but if they don't have tinnitus, they can ignore the tinnitus explanations, and then what use the therapy ideas are quite identical for tinnitus and hyperacusis, also for misophonia, and so those techniques can be used for them.
That's really helpful. Mm-hmm. And we can put links to all the things that you've talked about in the podcast notes here, so yeah, it's been really, really helpful. And I think, it, you know, given that the NHS hasn't widely adopted support for people with hearing difficulties, I think, you know, we need to fly the flag a little bit and talk about it and raise people's awareness, because I'm sure there are a lot of people listening to you tonight. I'm sure there are a lot of people in our service who have different levels of difficulty that you've described.
Exactly. So the NHS does services for people with hearing difficulties in terms of hearing loss, and provides the NHS hearing aids and all of the diagnostic tests for children from their birth. And so they do a lot of services in terms of people with hearing impairment. And that's kind of widespread throughout the UK. So the services are available and consistently doing what they need to be doing. And but then when you get to these niche areas like tinnitus and hyperacusis, then the actual services are less pronounced, and then there are difficulties in terms of practical difficulties. Like, for example, the therapy for tinnitus and hyperacusis is cognitive behavioral therapy, and cognitive behavioral therapy is a psychological intervention. And but psychologists do not really know much about tinnitus or hyperacusis, and audiologists know about that, but they do not have the appropriate training to actually do that sort of intervention. So they need to basically go, and either psychologists need to go and learn tinnitus and hyperacusis and these methods, or audiologists need to learn. So either way, they have to learn something extra, and that it is not in the usual bachelor or MSc courses, if you like. So that extra training is needed. And then the infrastructure and the support, for example, people in the psychological services, when they do CBT, they get a lot of supervision and support from other colleagues. And it is quite a well-structured approach, in a way of, first you see these people with this level of qualification. If you're not improved, then you see a higher person, and then a higher person. And so, and all of these gets weekly or monthly supervision from their superiors. And but in audiology services, when people learn to do CBT, then they'll go back to the service. This sort of a structure doesn't exist. Even clinical supervision, in a way that it is understood in psychology settings, is not recognized in audiology settings. I guess it's not even recognized in a speech therapy settings, that you guys don't sit with a supervisor every week and go through your patients. We don't do that. But this is what they do in for psychologists. And even if they are fully qualified and years of experience, they still have this regular clinical supervision. So that clinical supervision lacks in the audiology settings. But then if the patient has hearing loss, which a lot of them do, or other tests and bits and pieces needs to be done, then at least it is there and they can do that. In the psychology settings, anything with regard to the hearing aids that is whistling at the same time as the tinnitus and their hearing test that they need to do, all of those audiological complications, there is no support for that. So it's a kind of a separated services, unless, like, for example, in the private services like my institute, so we bring together psychologists and audiologists, occupational therapists, different background under the same roof, if you like, working on this particular condition. So they are basically supporting each other, but these kind of services are not really widely available. Majority is either you have to go and see a psychologist and say, okay, I don't mind that they don't know nothing about hyperacusis, or go and see an audiologist, knowing that they may not getting that level of scrutiny, if you like, for doing CBT. And so it's kind of more relaxed approach in doing CBT. So it's a bit of a practical problem there.
Mm-hmm. I think there's some changes, I think, happening. I think maybe brought this up previous episodes, just people kind of elevating themselves within their kind of professional skill set and adding extra strings to their bow. And I think I've heard of a few physiotherapists who've had specific cognitive behavior therapy training. Mm-hmm. allow them to work with other kind of client groups in a certain way and things. So it'll be interesting to see in the coming years, you know, if this sort of thing maybe becomes more adopted within the NHS and by, you know, a wider range of people. Absolutely, this is something language therapists could be helping with, you know, all part of that big banner of communication.
Exactly, it's because, you know, so hyperacusis can definitely impact on the person's communication, their attention, all of those things, and they can't even be listening to other people's voices. So I think, and you being already a therapist, and it's quite a good position to, specifically if it's a patient that you're already seeing for speech therapy and they also have hyperacusis, it makes sense to basically being able to take that role of helping them some level of CBT. I know many speech therapists who get trained up for some psychological interventions like motivational interviewing. And so MI has been, even audiologists has done that a lot to motivate people to use their hearing aids, for example. And so CBT is a little bit more intensive than MI. And but, you know, there are people who basically learn this, audiologists, social workers, hearing therapists, OT, and so and even within the field of psychology, like if you are a clinical psychologist, you may be trained to do you have to do some extra training actually to do CBT, and or if you're a health psychologist, you do not actually have any sort of CBT training that you can perform. So you, even a health psychologist, needs to get trained for CBT. And so, for example, health psychologists that work in my institutes, they get the CBT training for tinnitus and hyperacusis and misophonia. Instead of, if they were working in a different setting, they perhaps needed to get CBT training for OCD or anxiety disorders. And so it's, but this way they can, you know, get that extra training.
Well, I have to say, the amount of information that I've gained from this conversation is incredible. I didn't realise how little I knew. Is there anything else, though, Dr. Ash, that you feel that we've not covered?
Nothing from, maybe for children as well, and because some of your colleagues work with children, and children with on autistic spectrum disorders, that the prevalence of hyperacusis is quite high among them, and sometimes, depending, I say, high functioning, can they communicate, do they understand, how is their cognitive development, then it is quite tricky to actually do an intervention like CBT on an autistic child. And it is possible, but it depends on lots of, it's not possible in all of them. And so, and that is when it can become more difficult in dealing with them in a way that you actually want to. And but there are, in those cases, usually occupational therapists can use interventions which are more appropriate for their cognitive level. And some of those interventions may be classified as avoidance behaviors or ritualistic behavior in the terms of CBT. But then when CBT cannot be done, so those kind of interventions, like I've seen many people with ASD, that they use ear protection when they go to different places. I do not know if they actually are in, have they been assessed, whether they could have a different intervention, or this was the only thing that they could have give them. But I think that if possible, they need to be assessed if they can have an intervention like a simplified version of CBT, so they don't really become dependent on headphones. And if that is not possible, then headphones can at least help them to go to places that they want to go, although it maintains their hyperacusis.
And I'm feeling that there's a crossover with our brain injury population, that who might have cognitive difficulties, mm-hmm. that might pose a challenge to engaging in full CBT. But yeah, that's where it's back to an interdisciplinary approach to get the right the right tools and at the right level for that individual. So yeah, I feel like there's lots of areas that could be explored with regards to that. You need another master's student to look at.
Exactly. Yes, you have, as you mentioned, these people with brain injury, if their cognitions is impacted, so that being again very hard to actually do an intervention like CBT. And other interventions, like mostly OT interventions in those sort of field, in those sort of cases, can come in to see whatever they can do to use and help this person to access services and things.
Right. Well, Bashir, it has been an absolute privilege to have you join us tonight. I am so fortunate and pleased that you responded to my initial email and from some strange person asking if you would join us on a podcast to talk about this. You know, like Helen, I had no idea how little I actually knew. So thank you so much for sharing. And we'll make sure that people know how to find you and get more information from you through the links that you're going to share with us. So thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The opinions and views expressed in this podcast are of the individual and should not be considered professional advice. If you have a brain injury, suspect you have a brain injury, or think someone you know has a brain injury, please seek dedicated professional advice.